Hello, welcome back to Millennial 2018, and I'm now here with Rocking Mr. E from the channel Rocking Philosophy that I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with. Hello, welcome to Millennial.
And thank you for having me, Millennial Woes. I was, to be honest, it wouldn't be Christmas unless I was on Millennial, and it certainly feels like Christmas has begun now that I'm here.
Well, thank you very much for saying that. That's a very kind thing to say. It is interesting and very gratifying that this does seem to be becoming rapidly becoming a sort of fixture for many
people. Christmas tradition, like any other.
Yeah, it's great. I never realized it would become like this. But mind you, the first time I did it, I did say the advert said millennial, and then no reactionary will be alone this Christmas. That was the kind of slogan. And that was back in like November 2015, I think. So that was always a point of it, like to bring people together, because everyone was moaning at the time that there was no way to meet each other and that there weren't enough hangouts and stuff.
And community.
Yeah, exactly. But I think we're gradually remedying that in all sorts of ways, not just
we've got the alternative influence network, so everyone's kind of getting to know each other. And
Oh yeah.
I wasn't on that, and I'm a bit annoyed. You know, I think it was kind of like a badge of honor to be on the alternative influence network.
Oh yeah.
So you know, congratulations for that.
I was one of the biggest nodes on there actually, and it was bloody. I thought, oh wow, next to these other names, and I was bigger than more people who are more famous than me.
It's millennial, because, you see. It's millennial. It's making you the center of the note of the network.
It's specifically that. It's probably solely that, really, that this brings me into contact with all these other people, and you know, we collaborate evilly to the disgust of these left-wing censors. And of course, that's what we're going to be, well, largely what we're going to be talking about.
Indeed.
In this, because you, I mean, you have always been very concerned with individual liberty. Mm-hmm. And now we see that is under threat. Many people are talking about it, have been talking about it on Millennial. And I think that you are going to have a lot to say about it, given your own strong convictions about liberty. But I think that before we get into that, why don't you repeat what you... Because we did talk for about 20...
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, about 20 minutes before we went on air. And so we've already said quite a lot of things that we're now going to try to repeat.
That's what happens when two minds come together. And, you know, I've got... You know, a few friends in real life where you get together and you can actually have a good chin wag, and you know, you can't stop talking. So that's the inevitable result of people like you and I getting together.
Yes, exactly. So one of the things that we said before we went on air is you were talking about the British Constitution. So and as you said, a lot of people don't know that there actually is a British Constitution. So you take it away.
Well, I did make a video not long before this live stream called Lawful Rebellion and Brexit. And for me, you know, all things considered, it was a pretty successful video. You know, it didn't get like five-figure views, but my videos don't often get that many views anyway. But it got as many as five figures. It does happen over time. But this video's getting up there now. And I think it was one of those things where I was quite surprised that it would get that many views. But at the same time, I do wonder whether they've relaxed the shadow banning a little bit recently because of all this stuff with Google going up in front of Congress to be quizzed. So I don't know. It certainly feels a bit more relaxed at the moment.
It doesn't feel as on, like we're quite as on eggshells as we were a month ago.
Yeah, do you think that's why then? Do you think Google are trying to look good at the moment?
I have no idea. You see, it could just be an illusion. I mean, my channel could get a strike tomorrow, and then that would mean we couldn't finish Millennial. You know, I don't know.
And speaking of strikes, I mean, I did get a strike this year. It's been an interesting year. And of course, there's the whole situation with Brexit. And the thing is, it's got me thinking what course of action we have, what choices do we have, because Parliament is stacked to the rafters with Remainers. Of course, there was the whole situation with the Brexit challenge led by Gina Miller, who was funded by George Soros et al. Now, there's no democratic way we're going to be able to make any choices and any changes. So it's really frustrating. But saying that, people have forgotten what the UK, that we do have a constitution in this country, and it's one of the oldest constitutions in the world, it probably is the oldest, to be honest. And people have been deliberately, the history of that has been deliberately kind of pushed aside and kept away from the public, because they don't want the public to know that the establishment don't want the public to know that they do actually have constitutional rights that pretty much mirror the American constitution. Now, this is what I was talking about in this video called Lawful Rebellion and Brexit, because I wanted to do a video on Lawful Rebellion and the UK constitution, but I figured it would be a good idea to tie that into Brexit. Because number one, I think it would make the video more interesting for people because it would be a bit more topical then. But it would also help us understand what course of action we have in the near future. Because quite frankly, the way things are going next year, we're going to have to really think about taking to the streets. So, and when I say taking to the streets, I'm not even necessarily talking about violence or anything. I'm just saying that we're going to have to put pressure on the establishment through protest. And you've seen kind of glimmers of that now with very small scale yellow vest protests in the UK. And actually, obviously, the yellow vest protests come from France. They've never been shy about protesting. But the yellow vest protests seem to be inspiring people throughout Europe now. I think there's elements of it going on in Belgium, for example, and other parts of Europe. So this could be the start of a phenomenon in 2019.
I definitely think it's going in that direction, because these things don't, I mean, it's not going to just disappear. It's not going to just pack up and, okay, no more Brexit rallies, no more free speech rallies, no more yellow jackets, no more Tommy Robinson style stuff. You can't, I mean, well, first of all, the genie is out of the bottle. So there's that, which is a real phenomenon. And second, the forces that caused the genie to get out of the bottle in the first place are still as prevalent and as ever, and more so, increasingly all the time. So this stuff isn't going to end. So it's not. If it ends, it's not going to end by its own accord. Let's put it that way. It will end by overwhelming state force.
Yeah, absolutely.
Quelling it.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing. We're running out of time in that regard, because the aim is to move us towards a totalitarian international super state. We saw elements of it with the yellow vest protests being put down with military in France, which wasn't the EU army, but the militarized troops and vehicles had the EU logo on it. I didn't see any resemblance. I didn't see any French logo on it. So, or French flag on it. So that it gives you an idea of where we're heading if we carry on down this road.
It was such a telling and...
They were giving us a hint, really. They were warning us. It was a shot across the bow, so to speak.
Yeah.
So the question is, what do we do? I mean, we take to the streets. Parliament's not going to listen. So what choices do we have? What options do we have? Now, this is where we need to look at the history of Britain. And Britain was... It's got a very conflicted history in a lot of ways. It has this wonderful history of individual liberty and lawful rebellion via like the English Civil War that lasted from it's in the 17th century. Then you had the Glorious Revolution. It was in the 17th century. I'm not going to give you the exact date, but that went on for about 9-10 years. And then you had the Glorious Revolution a few years later, because even after that, I think that was about 10 years later or so. But what happened was the people rose up against the monarchy and the church who were repressing them. They managed to get their rights, to establish their individual rights. They got themselves a parliament, but then the same people used parliament to reestablish power. So we can see how history is repeating itself here. So essentially, we've got this history which is repeating itself.
The establishment always wins, basically.
Well, the establishment uses your system against you once you win, right? So the parliament has been used to push us back towards an absolutist system. So all those rights that we have, we fought for and won, we fell asleep. We fell asleep at the wheel and we lost those rights. But the thing is, what happened in the 17th century, because they'd already fought like 9 years of three, the English Civil War went on, like started and stopped over like, you know, three times over like a 9-10 year period. And that led to the 1689 Bill of Rights, which actually came later on. Actually, I remember the dates now. It was the 1688 Glorious Revolution. Right. So basically the English Civil War ended at around 1642. So then you got all that time then, about 36 years later, the establishment then used the parliamentary system that was established after the English Civil War to basically take back power. So what they did is they had a glorious, what the people did is they rose up and had a glorious revolution. And that's where the 1689 Bill of Rights comes in. So the history is basically, it goes all the way back to the common law, which was way back in like, you know, the ninth century. So, and this was based on the common law established by Alfred the Great. I mean, this is how far back the British Constitution goes. And that was based on the Ten Commandments and the Golden Rule. Now, this is very, Ten Commandments, Golden Rule, this is ultimately what individual liberty is supposed to be about. It's supposed to be about kind of respecting that we have certain moral laws to follow. The Golden Rule is don't do unto others as you would do unto you would have done unto yourself. I mean, this is common sense stuff in a lot of ways. But then after that, we had the Magna Carta, which came along in the 13th century. And from there you had the first statute of Westminster, which is where it was the first establishment of Parliament. But that was the 18th century. So actually the Bill of Rights came before that. And you had the Declaration of Rights before that, which led to the 1689 Bill of Rights. And of course, there's also the Coronation Oath, which is the monarchy's oath to uphold the law of the land. And to uphold the constitution, which leads me on to the situation with the queen, because she hasn't been sticking to her lawful duty to make sure that the constitution of Britain is upheld. So what happened in the 70s. It was the 1972 European Communities Act that was put into effect. Now, the European Communities Act was supposed to be about us having just a European community. It was not unconstitutional on its face. But the trouble is, it had the goal of the EU was always, you know, ever closer union, which is unconstitutional. And the Queen sat back and allowed that to happen. So I've always been very indifferent when it comes to monarchy. I find it quite antiquated, but I mean, surely, I think we've had enough we've had enough problems with monarchy now in Britain, where I think we should really think about considering a republic, really, because, you know, just a republic where we go back. My solution to this whole Brexit mess would be we go back to the laws of the land, the constitutional laws of the land prior to the 1972 European Communities Act, and we basically just say, well, the monarchy is essentially just leeching off the taxpayer now and not doing its sworn duty to uphold the constitution, because we live in a constitutional monarchy. So the aim of the monarchy is to uphold the constitution. So what's the point of having the monarchy if they're not doing that?
Well, this is something that you could say about various things that the Queen has not done, the various things that she hasn't protected over the last 60 years now, that she's been the Queen.
You've got to get the timelines exactly in your head. Certainly for me, since the 1972 European Communities Act, the Queen has failed miserably.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I think that defenders of monarchy would say that, well, that this isn't real monarchy.
That's the answer to everything, isn't it, when it doesn't work out?
To coin a phrase. Because it's symbolic only, and they're not actually...
But she does have a role, doesn't she? The role...
She has a role, of course. But that role is thwarted, or the performing of that role is thwarted by the various conventions that have arisen or grown up over time, which is that she, in theory, she's entitled to do this, like dissolve Parliament, that kind of thing. but she would never actually do it. It's only a formal thing that, you know.
Well, she technically doesn't have that right, really, because the Queen's, the coronation oath states very clearly that her duty, the monarch's duty, is to uphold the constitution. And part of the constitution is it's the First Statute of Westminster, which establishes a parliament. So everything kind of builds on the last, the first thing is built on, everything that comes before is built on whatever comes next is built on what was before. That's
of
what
course, but
that means that basically the Queen cannot simply abolish Parliament.
No, I didn't say abolish. Yeah. I didn't say abolish, though. I said devolve. And I know that, I mean, surely she can do that because that's formally necessary each time a new government is formed. The Queen has to dissolve the Parliament.
She can dissolve it and say, this is unconstitutional. We're going to establish a new Parliament and get rid of everyone. But ultimately, in the constitution of this country, you must have a Parliament, basically. Part of it. And that but Parliament is not. Parliament itself is also a representation of the will of the people, as well as the Queen. They can't act unilaterally. So the problem we have with Brexit is that we've been sold this cock and bull story that Parliament is sovereign, and Parliament wouldn't have any sovereignty if we didn't kind of lend it our sovereignty through our kind of unalienable rights as citizens of the United Kingdom or Britain.
Yeah. Yes, the ultimate power, the ultimate sovereignty lies with the people. And Parliament is just an expression of that. And of course, this is so important because our politicians have contempt for the public. There's just no denying that. It's so obvious at this point. And I think they behave as if, it's not even as if. They are doing it. If they don't have the public they want, they will import a new public.
Yeah.
So, which is exactly what they've been doing for the last 50 years. So they don't see themselves as our servants anymore at all. Very much. And not only is it reversed, it's grotesquely reversed, such that they see themselves as our engine. They are the engineers of us. They can re-engineer us if they.
And they're not allowed. This is why we have the right to lawfully rebel, which takes me to what I was leading towards. This is why we have the right to lawfully rebel. And what's more, in the Declaration of Rights and the Bill of Rights, it clearly states that no foreign prince, person, prelate, state, or potentate hath or ought to have any jurisdiction, power, superiority, preeminence, or authority, ecclesiastical or spiritual, within this realm. So every EU treaty is unconstitutional. Because you could, as long as anybody outside of the United Kingdom or Britain has any power over the laws of this land, that is unconstitutional. So we have a very legitimate case for treason, and we therefore have a very legitimate case to lawfully rebel.
Well, I think that it's worth. While you were talking, I wrote a sort of plan of the things that we could go through in sequence that would probably be advantageous conducive to telling this story clearly. Obviously, we could just go from one thing to another. That might be equally enjoyable for people. But I'm kind of OCD, and I think it would be fun to do this in a fairly vaguely structured way. And or at least that it'd be a good idea to hit each of these points.
I'll go with the flow. You're the boss. This is your millennial, so go for it.
It's my own fault for not doing this before we went on air. It only occurred to me as you were talking that we should have done this. Anyway, the point is that I think we should first the history of Britain, that this, well, obviously we're not going to go through the whole history of Britain. We've only got like an hour. But anyway, the stuff about power, constitution, parliament, sovereignty, and so on, that's obviously crucial background when we're talking about the situation today. So feel free to talk more about that, and then we'll move on to the situation today.
Absolutely. Well, I think that you got them bang to rights based on the Declaration of Right anyway. They cannot just transfer power to a foreign force. That's just not allowed. It's unconstitutional, and for good reason. So that is grounds for us to say, well, you know, Parliament is has basically committed an act of treason by transferring powers to the EU. So this is why they don't want us to know about these things. So I've done a lot of deep research into it. I actually went onto the British Constitution. I watched a video from the British Constitutional Group. Then I went to their website. I've done some other research as well and looked into the history of Britain, like the English Civil War, what's that all about? And then I looked into what happened afterwards and how there was this to and fro, just like today, wherein we have the people rising up and saying, we're sick of these absolutists pushing us around. We should have certain fundamental rights, irrespective of what happens in government. And I looked into that. I looked into the history of the British Constitution how it's evolved and been built on over like 1100 years of history. That's extremely impressive. And that's why I got to this point where I realized history has repeated itself. Because as I said, we had the English Civil War. It was a prolonged war, protracted war. And then 36 years later, they used the parliamentary system, the monarch and because there was the issue with the Catholic Church as well. They tried to take back over. They tried to take over England again. And of course, this is a fascinating history because it does tie into, you know, Protestantism as well. Now, for me, this has been an interesting year because I've kind of rediscovered Christianity. I've kind of reignited my faith from my younger years. But I have a newfound respect for Protestantism. I was raised as Christian Orthodox, Greek Orthodox. I still have a certain amount of respect for that religion, but I have a lot. I understand Protestantism so much more now. And Protestantism, you know, when you see the Americans with their constitution and the right to bear arms and all the fundamental rights within that constitution, that comes from the Protestant tradition. There's a darker side to that as well. I mean, you had the Freemasons trying to usurp it, but now we're really going down a rabbit hole. But you put it all together and you understand what this is ultimately a battle between absolutism on one end, people trying to kind of usurp the system so they can do whatever they like. And on the other hand, you have people saying, well, you know, the people have a certain amount of fundamental rights. They have certain fundamental rights. If you violate those rights, you have the right to lawful rebellion. So this is what we need to think about here. It's very easy to say, oh, well, you know, we need to think about what we're throwing away. If we decide to say, oh, well, everything's failed in Britain, we should just start again. We've got a fine tradition to go back to in Britain that we can reignite and use to get ourselves out of this mess. And really, other than that, what choices do we have? You know, because it's a noble tradition as well. And I think it's something that people can get behind and it can help people become patriotic, reignite their patriotism, because we can say, look at this history of 1100 years that Britain has of standing up to corruption and the people people fighting against tyranny.
Yes. Now that brings us to the next thing on the list, which is the current grievances things. Cause obviously you're saying tyranny and words like that. Describe that. What actually are the grievances? Because otherwise, it could seem, because I'm always conscious that people could end up watching this video who are not my usual viewers or your usual viewers. And so they might think, what are they even moaning about? What's the problem? So you go for it.
Well, the bottom line is the European Union. The biggest problem with the European Union, the biggest fundamental problem, is that it started off as an economic area and it's morphed into a political union. Nobody voted for that. And that's how they managed to get people to vote for it and under Thatcher. It wasn't Thatcher. It was just before she became prime minister, trying to get my history right here. So she was actually campaigning though, Margaret Thatcher, for the night to have the 1972 European Communities Act, because they thought it was just an economic area, economic community. So even Thatcher was duped. So then basically we've been had. There were clauses in there. Thatcher was being warned about this. And I think that's why they ousted her in the end, because Thatcher realized what was going on.
That is the sort of rumor that she was becoming too much of an obstacle for It's kind of like how JFK was becoming too much of an obstacle for the FBI and the CIA. So, that's one theory as to.
Well, it's a fact, really, when you think about it, because she stood up in Parliament and she said these people who are pro for the European project, they think that we should have the European courts having precedent over our laws. We should have a European Parliament. We should have all these things. And she said, no, no, no. That's what she said. It was a very famous speech where she said, no, 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 we don't want that. And that was when I think, not long after that, she got ousted because the Europhiles realized that she was going to become an obstacle. She realized what was going on. And so basically we were duped, and even Thatcher was duped. And that, and the audacity of the Remain side within the referendum that we had in 2016 was that they were trying to suggest that Thatcher was a Europhile. Thatcher was for free trade. Now this is how they've duped us for decades, is the idea of free trade. So the other problem is we can see this continuing to grow, because obviously Thatcher realized that they wanted to have the European courts having primacy over our courts. They wanted to have the customs union having primacy over the UK's customs laws, and the laws in general having primacy over the UK laws. So everything would have within the European project would have primacy. But then we see another product of that, another big lie that's come out not long after the referendum, which was the EU army. So once you can't even defend yourself because you don't even have your own troops, then you're screwed. Basically, you're screwed. So
you don't have, at that point, you don't have borders either. You've got to remember that's another part of the EU.
Absolutely,
you don't even have the borders that used to define you, and you don't in future you won't have the troops to defend those borders.
And how are you going to get your rights back? I mean, we haven't got guns. We lost our guns in the 90s, right, under Tony Blair, and he was a fanatical Remainer or Europhile that screwed us over there. So that was by design. You can see the pattern. It's the drip, drip, drip of moving us forward. We lost our guns in the 90s, and then the European project just went, it accelerated significantly after that. So we were told by the likes of Clegg and Miliband during the, it was actually in 2014 when we were having, when it was, I think Clegg and Farage had a debate in 2014 during the last European elections. And then Clegg accused Farage of being a fantasist for saying that we were going to have a European army. And then Miliband said when we had the election in 2015, when we had the debates for that, he said that Farage, that we're not going to have a European army. He repeatedly said that when Farage brought it up. And hey, presto, here we go. We've got a European army. Now, the annoying thing about this is the Leave side is constantly being accused of lying. I mean, it's just pure projection, and I am sick of it, to be honest. I'm furious about it, and I can see people getting angrier and angrier. But the worst thing about it is not only are they projecting their lies onto the people that want to leave the EU, they've stacked Parliament to the rafters with Remainers and Europhiles. So even if you can't get selected to run in politics as a Leaver, then what are you going to vote for? Who are you going to vote for?
Yeah. And that is a crazy situation. But I think it's worth saying that this is not just about the EU, because our own politicians, our own government is also against individual liberty. I mean, that's another part. I don't know if you want to go into that, or do you want just to focus solely on
Sorry, what did you say? Wait, what? Say that last bit again?
I said that there are problems with, the totalitarian, an emerging totalitarian tenor to the British government, the British state.
Yeah, and that's what happens when people go to sleep. And the trouble is now we've lost our arms, so we can't. I mean, it's going to be hard. It would have been hard at the best of times to simply stand up with and fight the government in this modern technological age. They're so well armed. It's very hard to do. And we don't unless half the army took the side of the people, in a similar vein to what happened in the 17th century, where at least a third of them stood up against the king, then you're not going to be able to do much. So we're not, the chances of getting Oliver Cromwell back, someone like Oliver Cromwell back with the roundheads, is limited. Now, I have thought about this, And for me, we need to basically blockade. I think we should blockade peacefully, mind, peacefully blockade Parliament, which means you just shut it down by getting enough people around Parliament to make sure that they can't continue with their proceedings. And if you can get inside, frankly, I'd say that was fine. That would be even better. But you do without any violence. You take a leaf out of Gandhi's book. No violence whatsoever. You let them beat you. Because that's hard to do. It's actually quite hard to let people beat you, but you've got to make sure that you expose them for who they are, and you prevent Parliament from continuing by saying we have the right to lawfully rebel. We are not going to allow Parliament to continue until we have a constitutional convention. You repeal the 1972 European Communities Act, and you go back to the constitution as it was prior to that. And that would be, this is me speculating now, but I don't really know what choice we're going to have if we end up having this stupid withdrawal agreement. We need enough people to take to the streets to blockade Parliament and force the government to show how totalitarian they are. Eventually, they may not care about the optics of that, a bit like Tiananmen Square with China. So we're running out of time. And if we don't take this, I don't know what other options there are, because the idea of a physical hot conflict with a seditious fifth column in this country is very difficult to imagine.
Well, but again, I'm thinking, what would somebody think who knew nothing about this and who just listened to this hangout and they heard you saying we need to do what you just said? They would wonder, what are the grievances? Why?
I don't know if it's that hard to understand at this point, though, because
I'm not being a dick about this. I just want to have this absolutely clear for people.
Okay.
So why don't you list what is the problem? What is wrong with today?
Well, basically, apart from the fact that it's unconstitutional and we've lost our sovereignty in Britain, you know, we've got the issue where the EU itself is becoming tyrannical. It's not truly democratic anyway. You've got the European Commission that cannot be elected. So it's undemocratic. It's anti-democratic, actually, because you can't actually put bills through the EU, through the European Parliament. You just basically have to vote for things. There's so many things you vote for that basically you can't read it all. There's too many, hundreds and hundreds of pages, thousands even. So you can never really know what you're voting for. And so that in itself is bad news. So then you're going to end up having ever more centralization of power at the top, which always becomes tyrannical. It's already begun anyway. The EU doesn't listen to anyone. As soon as it gets an army, it will become a rerun of what happens every time you get heavily centralized power. It becomes incredibly tyrannical. But if even none of that convinces you, there are the connections with the EU to old communists, like, for example, Juncker was a Trotskyite, and the previous European president, the president of the European Commission, was a Maoist. For example, he was an Italian.
Oh, Emmanuel Barroso.
That's right, yeah.
I think he was Portuguese. But,
right, yeah. Okay. Was he Portuguese? But I'm sure there's a couple anyway. But yeah, I'll take your word for that. But I know that there's a few of them. If you even look at Angela Merkel, she had ties to the East German communists. So, but if you want evidence of how tyrannical this is, I mean, just look at the concerns down the road with Article 11 and Article 13. These people have been pushing for the Chinification of the internet in Europe. So we might not be able to do this next year because of Article 11 and Article 13, basically. Not meaning that YouTube is not going to be available for access within the EU.
And you know what's even more ridiculous is that even if Britain leaves the EU, this is something that we will undoubtedly still be subject to, because they've basically said that, you know, Britain is still going to inherit all of these laws that are directives that are created in the EU. So this would still be the case even for Britain if we left the EU. There would be no more YouTube in Britain. God.
Which is what they want, because Theresa May has been kind of piping up about how she wants, there's a big problem of far right people online. So this does their job for them. I think with YouTube, maybe they have had a change of heart to a degree, but not because they believe Google is truly a free speech company. I just think they don't like the idea of the EU transferring power over the internet to them instead of Google having it. So there's a to and fro here, and people have clearly said in relation to pushing Article 11 and Article 13 forward within the EU, the people voting for that and pushing for it have said that we need to take power away from Silicon Valley. So what happens when you have strongly centralized systems is you'll have the battle then between the two sides, between multiple forces to consolidate and to be in control, which is why you end up with somebody like Stalin at the top. That's the logical conclusion of constant centralization. You'll end up with a tyrant.
And I mean, Article 11 and Article 13, can you remember? And I remember the thing about the memes, the copyright, but what was the other one? I can't remember what it.
So we got 11, I think Article 11, and I can't remember exactly which order it was, but I know Article, one of them was the link tax. So Article 11.
That's the link tax.
Article 11 and 13 together cover the link tax and also the fact that you need to put a filter on for copyright. So YouTube would have to, it would be so much work for YouTube to actually monitor that. It would actually be better for them to leave, to stop providing a service to the EU, because they would get, because the way they do it, the way they want to do it to make sure this takes place is they're going to fine YouTube. They'll fine the provider. So that would mean YouTube could go broke because there'd be so many copyright infringements. Even for my videos, I take a screenshot of an article or something like that. That sort of thing could be copyrighted now. But if in a video, I'll take a screenshot of something and put it in as a still. That would all be subject to Article 11 and 13 within the EU.
It's so stupid that, I mean, I've linked to your website in the description to this video. Mm. So I guess I would have to somehow prove that it was okay for me to do that. You've given me permission to link to your website. Otherwise, the link tax.
Exactly.
Or would I have to pay a link tax even if you had given me permission to link to your website? Though it's benefiting you to be linked to. I mean, it's just fucking mad.
And they know, right, that smaller content creators aren't going to have the resources to enforce it. What they want to do, the big media companies, the legacy media, they do. So that it actually benefits them for me. Whatever I put in my videos, I link to, right? So if I mention an article or put a still to an article or read any part of an article, I'll always link to it. And that includes any video clips.
Because you're on the internet. And that's what we do on the internet. You know, we hyperlink to things.
Yes.
That's the whole point. That's what both words, inter and net, imply this very thing that the EU is abolishing.
So it drives traffic to these sites. But they know that if they shut people down using these rules, these laws, even though they'll lose traffic in the short term, once all their competition dies off, we'll be back to the 1980s where you had these dominant media companies. And that's the end of the alternative media, which at which point we will start to have China-style internet. That's what the EU wants. The EU is based only a few steps away from a Chinese-style model anyway. If you abolish the European Parliament, we'd have the Soviet Union or Chinese Communist Party system. That's what's so scary about this. All you'd need to do is abolish the European Parliament and it would be exactly the same, because you'd have the council, and then at the top, then you'd have the committee, you'd have a committee slash council, and then at the top, you'd have the Politburo, which would be essentially be the European Commission.
I mean, it's an awful thing. And I think that the British people have never been comfortable with it. I think Britain as a country has never really belonged in the EU. It was always, I think, sort of natural and inevitable that we would be the first country to leave the EU. I know that Greenland left it in 1982 or whatever, but that's doesn't really matter. The EU as we know it today wasn't even really developed at that point, so it's not really relevant. I think it was natural that Britain was going to leave because it is not our sort of thing. But of course, having said that, I don't think it really jives with the mentality of any European country, except perhaps France, but only the state of France. I don't think it jives with the mentality of French people. You know, it doesn't really, it's not an expression of any European people.
Who wants a political union, really? Who really wants it? That's the question. I think people are getting sick of it. The French are getting sick of it, but they're just getting... The problem is, I mean, the French don't have the great tradition, the great constitutional tradition we have in Britain. We have a way out because we actually have a constitutional route to get out of this mess. The French don't. They had a terrible... I mean, think about how much worse the French Revolution was to what the Glorious Revolution of 1688. The French Revolution led to massive bloodshed and Napoleon. So you can see how Britain is a very... It's a very contradictory, conflicted country. It has this great tradition of individual sovereignty and constitutional law. But at the same time, it has had some issues. And I personally know of those issues as a Greek Cypriot. I've seen what they do when you have a referendum and then they just basically, they dismiss it and fob you off. That's actually probably one of the reasons why I'm so acutely aware of what's going on, because they did it to the Greek Cypriots when they had a referendum because they wanted to reunify with the Greeks when they gained independence. So they didn't allow it, and to actually put a spanner in the works, what they did is they turned the Turks, they got the Turks involved, so then they told them that they should have their say on the island as well. They should have control over the island, and there's military and strategic issues if the Greeks get the island because of the history of the Greeks and the Turks. And then now Cyprus is an island which is divided. So this is what I think the immigration is about, by the way. And this ties into why I think I've got a history and an awareness of what's going on. It's the divide and conquer strategy, of which there's been numerous examples in history when the British Empire began to fall apart, like in India, for example, with the Muslims. So now they're actually bringing in all these people from outside who have no, who don't feel British. And if the British do try to stand up, this is why time is of the essence. The more non-British people you have here, the more likely it is that they're going to be able to do the same thing as they did in Cyprus, where they'll turn to and they'll divide us up into different ethnic groups, different political groups or religious groups, but different ethnic groups. And then they'll pit us against one another. And Britain will be divided forever then, and there'll be no way out.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think this is something that has been in motion for decades. I don't know if it was deliberately, consciously chosen by the powers that be, but I think it's certainly going on now. I think they must know that this is going to be the end result of the current trends, and yet they're absolutely, clearly determined to continue on this journey, this trajectory. So what we're going to end up with, as you say, is basically a demos that, well, has no unity or cohesion at all and cannot function in any productive manner. It's just going to be a bunch of groups vying with each other, and there'll be endless resentment and mutual suspicion and paranoia and loathing of a cultural kind, a religious, racial, everything. And, well, then what do you need? I mean, it's a famous thing said about Iraq is that you've got all these tribes, sects, and the only way to stop to have any kind of peace
is exactly a strong man.
You've got to have an authoritarian state just to keep people from killing each other. A similar thing in Singapore, obviously very different, but it's the same principle. In order to prevent all of these different groups from hating and killing each other, or at least just making life unpleasant for each other, you've got to have a police state that with very hardcore restrictions, curtailments of individual liberty.
And that's the deliberate aim, because the EU is going to regionalize. It's going to split us up into different regions. That's part of the idea.
And also another part of that is, but not only splitting states up, but also arbitrarily merging different states. Did you hear about the Arc-Manche region, which was like the southeast corner of England, and then the nearest bit of France, and they were going to call this the same region and claim that it had a unique a shared history? It reminds me of nothing. It's just it's like Belgium. It's a it's a completely arbitrary and fake construct that is then going to sort of just malfunction because it doesn't have a history. It doesn't have an identity. It's a farce.
But the other option is, I think the most viable strategy would be that you just put, they've already done it in Britain where you'll have the Welsh and the Scots against the English and the, you know, the Celts against the English. And that's one way, but now they've done it already, but now you're going to get like, I don't know that we've already got a lot of Muslims here. And then there's the African population, they'll separate into their different groups. And then basically Britain will, like London, you could quite easily see London separating and becoming its own independent area, which was run by Brussels. That's what, so there is no real, so the parliament in London will just end up being in charge of the region of London. Nothing. And then of course we've already got an assembly in Wales. We've already got a Scottish parliament. And we've got a Northern Irish parliament. This is why I'm against this. I'm against devolution. It's pointless. We're a small country. And now Wales is going to have tax raising powers, which is where I live, which I dread about because my taxes will inevitably go up in Wales now because the Welsh are so socialist. So, I mean, you can see where it's heading. So if the English get too uppity, for example, because they want to have their country back, they'll just bring in other groups to attack them and they'll make them into the boogeyman. And then eventually you saw it in France. And no, we're not in France, in Mao's China during the Cultural Revolution. And originally everybody rose up against the former landowners prior to the revolution and then the communist revolution. But then afterwards, after a certain amount of time, when the Red Guards became too powerful and too uppity, they then said to the people who were being oppressed that they could now attack them. They weren't allowed before. So they don't really care about different factions. As long as they're in charge and they're distracting us, this is the model that they're going to use against us. And we have lots of history of that.
And plenty of evidence of it being of it developing right here and now. And being deliberately developed as well, being stoked, being nurtured.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if that is the only reason that for the demographic remixing of European countries, but it's definitely one reason. It's definitely going to be advantageous to an elite that clearly, even today, feels very little connection with the various peoples of Europe, the various peoples that they supposedly serve. As I said earlier, they don't see themselves in that as servants of the people. They see themselves as engineers of the people. And well, yeah, literally they are re-engineering the people. And I think that, you see where it's inevitably going to lead. But I think that, I don't know if there's any more to be said about that.
History, but you can go on and on. I mean, there's Yugoslavia. I've already mentioned India. This is what I mean about Britain. It has a wonderful history of its constitution, but as a colonial power, it was pretty merciless, and it used the right divide and conquer in a more ruthless way than any empire that came before it. And that's probably why it became so large. And now we've got this reverse colonialism where these forces, these elites, their bloodlines are going to turn this against us, the people now. I don't blame the British people for what happened in Cyprus. I understand it really had very little to nothing to do with them. And British people are overwhelmingly sympathetic of the fact that Turks have taken over a large part of Cyprus. But there is this elite cabal throughout Europe, and whatever country they come from, that see themselves they see themselves as closer to one another than they do to their countrymen. That's what I see.
Yeah, it's the sort of Davos crowd and Brussels. I mean, and someone like Nick Clegg, you know, I'm sure they can hail from individual countries, but they have a certain mentality which draws them towards not the power so much, but the culture of the power centre, the sort of internationalist, globalist, progressive, social democracy. You know, they seem to, I mean, someone like Nick Clegg, you know, what on earth connection does he actually have to Britain? You know, he's like a showroom dummy, and they all are.
He's just a cosmopolitan tough, isn't he? Let's be honest. There's nothing real about him. I mean, this is, for me, it's strange for me because, as I say, I know that I'm not ethnically British, but I do love this country, and I want what's best for it. But at the same time, I want a Europe where everybody gets their own version of Brexit. I just want to go back to that. And I see Britain as a country that can lead the way. And then hopefully France would probably be next, actually. And then you may get, I want it to filter down until we get to Greece and Cyprus, which is where my ethnic heritage comes from.
Yeah, yeah. But the other side of all this, which I hinted at earlier, and we were talking about it before we went on air, is the, and it is quite a departure from what we've been saying so far, but it is also connected to it, is the censorship and heavy-handedness of the British state. Because the other side to this matter is, you know, people could say, okay, you can leave the EU, but so what? You're still going to be under the thumb of a British state that does not have your interests at heart. And what we've seen this year in Britain with the arbitrary arrest and imprisonment of Tommy Robinson. Now, I know that a lot of people on my channel are not fans of Tommy Robinson. I don't care. That's irrelevant. The point is that what happened to him was unjust, and it was unjust. At this point, that's been established in a court of law that he was wrongly imprisoned. It was all done in one afternoon. And then you've got the banning from this country of Lauren Southern, Brittany Pettibone, and Martin Selner. And then you've got the Count Dankula thing as well. So that's all in this year alone. And then you've got people being put in prison in such a way as to physically endanger them. I mean, make them vulnerable to physical attack, physical violence, which could well lead to permanent injury or even death for people who've merely been given a prison sentence, but really the state tries to make it a death sentence. That seems to have been what happened, or they tried to do with Tommy Robinson this time. And there are many aspects to this that are, and it is increasingly scary.
I certainly agree with that. It's been a terrible year. I mean, I got my first strike. It has expired, but I kind of changed tact in a lot of ways now. I'm only doing one video a week at the moment. I'm not doing live streams right now, although I might do a few over Christmas. I've got a few things in the bag that I'm doing I haven't talked about publicly yet, but I'm trying to diversify basically because of what's coming down the road. So what's 2019 going to be like with the way things are going? But we can kill two birds with one stone, going back to what you said. This is why we need to have that constitutional convention. We need to go down the lawful rebellion route, peaceful lawful rebellion. I'm not advocating violence. There's just no way that would work. I mean, Gandhi himself said he would have used violence if he had the weapons, but he didn't. But we need some kind of peace. We need enough people to take to the streets to blockade Parliament. I mean, how easy that would be, I don't know. But people are getting increasingly frustrated. And if we don't leave on the 29th of March, who knows? We might get several hundred thousand on the streets. But we need to, that needs to be protracted over time. And this for me seems to be the best way forward, because we can push for the constitutional convention and we can just completely abolish the 1972 European Communities Act, which we could have done in the beginning, by the way. There's the bizarre situation of what had happened with Andrea Leadsom, because she's a totally different person now. But when she was actually running against Theresa May, she should repeal the 1970. Do you remember that? Where she said we should repeal the 1972 European Communities Act. She's a completely different person today, which tells me that these people, they're pretty, who knows what they say to people behind the scenes. But I think there's a lot of blackmail and threats that we don't know about. Obviously, this is speculation, but for somebody to change that much, she was one of the stars of the Leave campaign.
I remember today. I was excited when there was a possibility that she was going to become the leader of the Conservative Party, but then Theresa May got the job. It's dreadful. But as you say, she And I just discovered today that she's now the leader of the House, of Commons. And I thought, that's a bit surprising. Because, you know, I remember her as this sort of firebrand to trying to get us out or advocating that we leave the EU.
And now all of a sudden she completely agrees with Theresa May's withdrawal deal. And she gave, you know, Theresa May had no she had no real challenger. She was just, she just had a coronation to become leader. Nobody challenged it. Just Andrea Leadsom stepped down. Why? Because then if Andrea Leadsom had gone to the membership to have a vote, she would have won. I'm certain of that. Because the membership of the Tory party is overwhelmingly pro-leave. So this is what, and this is, we're stuck now. Because obviously we had the vote of confidence recently. This is another example of how there's no way out of this mess. Because we had the vote of confidence. We waited. Do you remember all the speculation about that? How many letters have we had? We finally got the 48 letters, and it was just the fart in the wind. It amounted to nothing.
Yeah. So yeah, she's still there. And the very strange thing about it all is that this is only going to really damage the Conservative Party's chances of winning the next election, just as Trump's inaction and acquiescing to the Democrat Party, that has only damaged his chances of getting re-elected. And I'm not going to go into the America thing, because everyone else talks about that. This is our thing now. for now. But I'm just drawing that comparison. The fact is, why would anyone vote for the Conservative Party? And, you know, the only answer really is, well, I'm fucking terrified of Jeremy Corbyn and Diane Abbott getting any power.
It's a really lame reason. And the trouble is, the Tories they have resigned themselves to the political wilderness over this. But the trouble is, I do think it will bode well for UKIP. But the trouble is, there's no time. There's no time. Now, this is why we need to look at our constitution in detail. We need some very brave people to come out and start speaking up about this, who are lawyers as well. We need a whole movement. The time to sit back and get very comfortable and remain comfortable is over. I suggest people they enjoy their Christmas and then really get mobilized in the new year. There was some yellow vest protesters that held up traffic, and they were protesting outside Parliament. But it's going to be organic and grassroots, genuinely grassroots, if it happens. But even then, there's the risk of it being co-opted, like in France, they're trying to co-opt it by saying things like, oh, you know, number one thing on the Yellow Vest Manifesto is 100% employment and 100%, you know, and the end of all homelessness. You can see how they're trying to co-opt it.
Yeah, make it urban and cosmopolitan.
Yes.
I mean, it's those concerns. Whereas it started in the rural areas, where they're not going to say things like that, commie crap like that.
Exactly. So, I mean, I think there is a silver lining here. I wonder if it will go down this road, because it's going to be very difficult for the authorities or the police to arrest people that are peacefully protesting, not damaging anything, not smashing anything up. Just blockading. That's it. In a very Gandhi-esque way. We need to take a leaf out of Gandhi. I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of Gandhi. He was far too socialist for my liking. But I do think he had a very good idea there. Because we're dealing with a colonial power, essentially, at this point. The EU is a colonial power. A reverse colonial power.
Not just that, but I would say globalism is a colonialist power.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, do you have any opinions, Millennial Road, in terms of
I think it won't happen next year.
Okay.
But I think that things will happen next year. But I think that your idea of blockading Parliament and so on, I don't think that will happen next year. But I think that things are, as I said at the start, just inexorable now. It's in motion. All of the forces are only gathering momentum. And something has been established this year in London, which we didn't actually talk about on air, but there is something, and I talked about it in my TBG speech, which will be going up on Christmas Day, by the way. There is some sort of embryonic movement was born in London about a year ago, and it involves Tommy Robinson, Sargon of Akkad, UKIP, various other figures. And I think that this is the start of a sort of cultural push for a cultural movement. And I think it's, I mean, I know that people will be saying, well, Sargon this and Sargon that. It doesn't matter. The point is that something has been born, and it came, it happened organically. It was grassroots, and it happened in response to forces that all of us resent. And those forces are only getting stronger all the time and getting more aggressive all the time. So therefore the rebellion, the counterculture, will only get stronger all the time. And so, well, what has been established in London this year is the idea that you can actually, I think there has been meaningful rebellion for the first time in decades. I don't know how long, 50 years. I mean,
you can see it building up.
It's something. Yeah, it's something real, but it's not some manufactured load of rubbish, like Woodstock or something. This is actually real, and it's coming from, these crowds have, men, there are men in those crowds whose daughters have been raped by Pakistani Muslims. And that is a very, very real grievance. And, it's a real thing that people are going to care about. They are going to be, they're genuinely angry about it. I mean, when there was that protest, I think in, was it May, June, July, sometime around then, and there were men climbing the gates of Downing Street. When does that last happen? Something that symbolic and potent. But why did it happen? It's because there is something going on in the country that is extremely unsettling for people, enough that it would drive them to do something like that.
The longer we wait, the more people we're going to need to take the streets. And obviously violence is not, it's just not viable on a number of levels, right? But I mean, my dream would be something along the lines of V for Vendetta, where people, so many people came into London that they thought the police couldn't stop them if they tried. And I don't know if we'll reach that point, but the idea of the mask and the cloak where they can't, that was a great scene right at the end. You know that film, V for Vendetta?
I haven't seen it, actually.
It's very good. The ending was great. It was just, the masks they all wear, the Guy Fawkes masks? So you all had the masks on and the cloaks, but that was very symbolic. And you can't have that velvet revolution. And it's very difficult for them to call you extremists if you're not even advocating violence. The trouble is you'll get the saboteurs that go in there and they'll try to pose as one of you. And that's always going to be a risk. But I mean, as I say, if we're not going to start standing up for our rights, if and when we don't leave on the 29th of March, if we don't leave the EU, that is, then when is it going to happen? Because my concern, which I've been saying throughout this live stream, is that the longer we leave it, the more difficult it will be, because this force we're up against is going to get more and more authoritarian. It's going to be a mix of the kind of distractions and the hedonism of Brave New World with that threat of the Orwellian state in the background. So as soon as you step out of line, bang. That's what we're going to experience, which is why I think, Huxley and Orwell, they both were onto something, but they weren't quite there where you could see how those two systems are actually, when you put them together, that's more like what we have today.
Yeah, I mean, I remember reading somewhere that Huxley said to Orwell that Huxley thought that his vision was more feasible because people prefer pleasure to pain, basically. And so you can... what's that term? You catch more flies with honey or something, whatever it is. And that's true. If you were wanting to control people, you would control them by giving them meaningless pleasure. So sure. But the other part of it, though, is that...
you can't control everybody like that.
Yeah, and there's only so much pleasure. There's only so much pleasure to go around, and sometimes people don't want it. Yeah, so it doesn't work, and so you have to then switch from the carrot to the stick. We're using so many metaphors here,
yeah.
And get tough and get nasty, and room 101. So
yes, audio feast for the listeners.
The thought police, thought crime, and so on. And yeah, so obviously, I mean, really, it's soft totalitarianism, isn't it? That's the term that's in vogue in Germany just now, and I think that it's we should probably bring it into vogue in Britain as well.
Yeah, absolutely. We've also got the idea of God, what was the other word? There was in one of Black Pigeon Speaks video. We talked about a certain kind of anarchy wherein there was
anarcho-tyranny.
Anarcho-tyranny, that's the one. That's really what we have. The law only applies to certain people, and because we're the majority and we have the power to act, the people who talk like us, we have the power to make real change. So they are oppressing us through anarcho-tyranny and a number of things. They're also trying to distract us with pleasure. And of course, if you have people you care about, you want to give them a certain amount of stability in their lives and what have you, they have ways of making you compliant. But I must say, one other thing that I have noticed is the big problem with Northern Europe is they're just too obsessed with the economy and money, you know, and it's keeping people in very, this is why I think we're accelerating so much quicker in Northern Europe to tyranny, to authoritarianism. Whereas if you go down south or even east, they're not as preoccupied with money. I mean, you see the Germans, how obsessed they are with the economy and their brands like Audi or Hugo Boss, or both brands I like, but that's not the be all and end all. Where's your culture? Where's your heritage? And this is what, if you think about what it's like in the other places in Europe, I mentioned north and south and east, they don't tend to prioritize economics as much as those things like your heritage and your culture. And yes, they're poorer, but maybe we all need to get a little bit poorer. Maybe that's actually a good thing in some ways. Not in like, I'm not talking about an absolute poverty type of kind of way, or even kind of an abstract poverty kind of way. I'm talking about just not having so much concern with having the latest gadgets, the nicest homes, and just, you know, repair things from time to time, or don't just think that the be all and end all is going shopping and drinking and boozing and just kind of getting your senses on fire, you know?
A sort of meaningless existence, you know, just consumption.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, completely. You know, you're going to get no disagreement from that on my channel. Yeah. But yeah, I think it's important to emphasize that what we're talking about is tyranny from the EU, tyranny from the British state, and tyranny from the internet companies, the censorship and so on. And all of this interacts.
They're all one force, aren't they? Because the EU
effectively, even though they have some disagreements, like with Article 13 or whatever, ultimately they are all working against the peoples of the world, but it's, in our case, the peoples of Europe.
Absolutely. I mean, the EU was designed, globalism, I've always likened it to like corporate fascism with the culturally Marxist side of it as well. It's like a hybrid ideology. And part of that is the corporations. There's a revolving door with the elites within this globalist system. You've got Tony Blair, he ends up being like on the board of JP Morgan.
Yeah. Do you know that Nick Clegg is now working at Facebook?
Well, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Yeah,
I did hear that. Yeah. And that's exactly what I'm talking about.
It's hilarious, isn't it? Well, it's not hilarious. It's both. It's kind of blankly humorous. And another thing is that, you know, you've got this sort of, you know, the council board member who'll then end up on the board of a charity on a six-figure salary, or he could go to a corporation, or he could go into government, or he could go to the EU, or whatever. But there's incredible fluid motion between all these power centers. It's the same people, just like in Silicon Valley. It'll be someone who'll go from Twitter to Facebook and so on. It's a similar sort of thing.
And this is why we've got a false dichotomy now, where you get the hardcore libertarians. They will blame everything on the state, everything. Then you've got the hardcore communists. They will blame everything on corporations. But when I look at corporations, I mean, they're pretty culturally Marxist, if you ask me. They're like very pro SJW. They're dominated by SJWs. And really, none of the, when it comes to authoritarians, as long as they're the ones in charge, they really don't care. about anything. So this is why, no matter how, as much as I would describe myself as a kind of, I'm a nationalist, but I'm like, you can call me a libertarian nationalist or a conservative nationalist. I don't really care. But or even call me a nationalist capitalist if you want. I believe that the state exists to protect national sovereignty. And you can trade, but this idea of unadulterated free trade where everywhere, like not only capital, but people can move freely over borders is very dangerous. And we need to go move away from that as quickly as possible.
Yeah, because it is destroying us. And you can see that manifesting in all sorts of different ways. You know, culture, morality, and of course, demographics.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that the iconoclast is giving you a super chat there. So
yes, I'll just read it out. I tend to leave the super chats to the end because I don't want to break the flow of the conversation. Of course, the downside is that I often then forget to read the super chat.
Yeah, I've had that problem.
Really dreadful. But anyway, he says, really enjoy Rocking Mystery. Great talk. I'd buy you both an alcoholic beverage or a Coke in Colin's case. Cheers. So thank you, Dan, for that. That's very
kind. And I do enjoy watching the Iconoclast's channel, and he's just taken off this year astronomically, like through the roof, like, you know. So he's become one of the bigger channels among our community, I suppose.
Definitely. He's completely skyrocketed. It's fantastic. It's a great success story. But of course, there's Way of the World as well. He's now up at, I think, nearly 80.
But does he even do videos on YouTube anymore because of all the censorship? Because he's got one channel pulled down this year, which ties into what we were talking about.
Yeah.
Then he put another one out.
And then it's grown. It's great. When he got taken down, it had 20K. And he started a new one, and it's got 80K. And that's, nearly 80K, all in 1 year. So he is fantastically successful.
Absolutely. I mean, it's good to see that there is some freedom there to act before without getting shut down. I don't know how these things work half the time, but
I don't think anyone does. You know, I did a speech called Machinery of Silence about 2 months ago about this. And, you know, part of it is that it's all just so random and arbitrary and totally unpredictable.
I have my theories, but the trouble is, I mean, certainly in my case, I'm always very polite. And I try to be as circumspect as possible, but I don't have it. I will talk about anything. I've even touched on the Holocaust this year. I'll say no more, but that video got put into limited state. But the thing is, if you're like that over time, I think the eye of Sauron will turn and notice you more. So, I mean, there isn't much I haven't talked about over the years. So maybe that could explain some of the issue with my channel. But obviously, it's one of those things where I'm going to keep doing this until I drop dead because I need this outlet and I want to feel like I'm making a difference. But also being somebody who likes to think philosophically, if I can't express myself, I think I would go mad. So this has been a very doing this is very therapeutic for me, that's for sure.
Well, we should do it more often.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's certainly been it's always... I don't know about you, but when you end up speaking to somebody and you're able to kind of speak from the heart and and speak freely, you can speak for hours, you know. And as I said, I've got one or two friends like that, and we'll just talk and talk and talk and talk endlessly, and we'll never stop.
Yeah, I know the feeling. I mean, part of it is that's part one of the reasons it's difficult to maintain a structure with these millennials, because it's often someone that I only speak to once a year or never before, or it's somebody who's never had a chance to speak about that particular topic before. So there's a huge amount to say, but it seems to go okay though. I think people do enjoy them. So
well, they certainly must do, because you've had a lot of views, but you know, I'd like to think that this discussion has been somewhat coherent, and we thrashed out a few things that with a thread going from start to end.
I think the
fundamental theme here is basically Brexit, censorship, and what we talked about, what my solution is in terms of understanding the great constitutional history that Britain has. I think that's the only real way out Britain has in all these regards.
I think you're probably correct. Now, when I said that I don't think that this will happen next year, I didn't in any way want to sort of poo-poo the idea.
No, not at all. I know you weren't doing that.
Yeah, It's just, I think that the situation isn't quite there yet, but something is coming. And, you know, one of the things I said in the TBG speech, which we haven't really gone into at all here, is that I do think that it's not just liberty versus tyranny, and it's not just nationalism versus globalism, and it's not just white versus non-white or non-Islam versus Islam. I think that there is a growing need for a new culture, and an entirely new set of or new way of looking at the world that's emerging on the left and the right, actually.
I can see exactly what you're saying.
Yeah,
I do agree. I mean, nationalism. I mean, what does it mean to be a nationalist? That's the question. Now, I've had this discussion with you before and others, you know, that I did touch on the ethno-nationalist thing. For me, I don't really know if you can have, I don't want to sound like an SJW or somebody who's a denier of race, but there is no 100% pure anything. So you have to have a certain amount of leeway where different cultures of Europe can interact, for example. I mean, people fall in love and whatever, but at the same time, as long as you don't have mass immigration, these things will happen organically and naturally and they won't cause problems. But the reason, one of the things that fascinated me this year is when I did a DNA test and checked, because I know you did one as well, and you can see quite clearly that the idea that you're 100% anything is not very likely. But then how it just doesn't happen. So as long as you respect the idea of national sovereignty and you don't want to have open borders and you want to control immigration and you respect the culture, you respect that every country has its own every country has its own heritage. That for me is what it means to be a nationalist, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. I don't have any disagreements with any of that. Actually, with one of the previous hangouts this evening, I was saying a similar thing about the purity thing. But I don't want to sort of fixate on that because or focus on that. What I was saying just now is that I do think that we're on the cusp of quite radical social change, basically.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think part of that is if things continue down this road, there will be a nationalist alliance throughout Europe. And that, you know, to use popular culture again, I actually think we're moving to something akin to Star Wars, where you're going to have the Empire and then you're going to have the alliance of nationalists. So you're going to have,
yeah. You know,
this is why it doesn't, in the end, it's not going to matter what your ethnicity is, as long as you are nationalists that want it from across Europe, that want to put Europe back to how it was before the EU came along. And we're going to need to help each other achieve that.
Yeah.
And that will hopefully bring us closer to, in the sense that we'll see each other as a community in the real sense, where we have our own, a bit like the Greeks in the ancient world, they had their city states and they would argue and quarrel, but they would come together when it mattered. And that's how I see Europe in an ideal world, I think, preferably with less quarreling though.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, let's leave it to that, because that was a fantastic discussion. I really enjoyed it. And I think the chat did as well. There was one more super chat.
There was a super chat there. I did notice. Yeah.
Pre-programmed Ramona NPC. all right. Big fan of Mr. E. Both of you are top tier commentators. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that as well. That was very kind of you.
All right. Yeah. So, that's great. I've just had a really good time with this one. So thanks very much.
It's been great talking to you. I haven't done a live stream for ages. I'm going to have to get back into it at some point, but yeah.
It's a different thing, isn't it? It's a very different thing from pre-making videos. And I love it, actually. I've really got into it this year.
Yeah. It's certainly great when you've got someone to bounce off and talk to. It's very, for me, it's much easier when you've got someone to talk to. When you're talking to yourself, when nobody really there. With nobody really there, that's another thing altogether, isn't it?
But I like those live streams as well.
Yeah,
that's what I want to do. I think I might actually just do everything as live streams next year. I'm not sure yet, but I worry so much less about live streams. You know, if I do something pre-recorded, I get so worried about, you know, perfectionism.
Perfection, because you've got to accept the way it comes out when it's live.
It's great. You don't have the chance to get, you know, obsessive with live streams. It's just rough and ready. Everyone expects it to be that, so it's fine. It's,
I am very much a perfectionist. I see myself as a writer, really, so I like everything to be perfect. But I should relax a bit more and just, you're going to have some stutters and some ums and ahs in there, aren't you? You know?
Yeah, who cares? It really doesn't matter. But that's the thing. What matters is that, you know, you get the ideas out. Of course, it's always easy to say that to someone else. You know, let's leave it at that. This was great, and I really enjoyed it. Rocking Mystery.
Can I just say as well, before you go, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show. And as I said at the start, it wouldn't be Christmas if I didn't come on Millennial. So thank you for having me.
Oh, yeah, absolutely welcome. And thanks very much for taking part. Excellent. So I will be back in a little while. Let me see who's on next. Asha Logos, in about 20 minutes from now. So I'll probably be a very different hangout, and I'll see you then. Thanks for watching.